Okay, thank you, David. So this is what I be brief. Okay, let's get this in my pocket. This is what I thought I would do. What I think as physicists, what we you try to do always is find some approximation that allows you to make some progress, to get some intuition into a field. And I'll just sketch on the board a little bit the kind of intuition I think that took place in the 60s and 70s in just generating action potentials in cells. And it'll also serve as a means to sort of refresh everybody's memory as to, sort of one of the early triumphs in neuroscience and in theoretical neuroscience. But sort of one of the sort of challenges now, I think, both well, in part experimentally and in part very much theoretically, is to understand, what sort of approximations are useful to understand the dynamics of networks, of very many neurons together, many neurons and the connections between them, their synapses, which themselves often have some sort of non-trivial dynamics. And if you understand the dynamics, then maybe you can go ahead and make some sort of conjectures on how these elements are used to actually compute something. So there's been a push in a couple of directions. Sometimes it happens that you have neurons that will fire pulses, I'll describe in a second, and the pulses are all very fast, but there's some, the interactions between them, say, are very slow. So you could take sort of a limit as some time becomes very, very long, and average over lots of variables on a long time scale. Another sort of interesting limit, which is the focus of the presentation, is when you have neurons that interact, which in a way which is weak, and one can define this rigorously, and weak in the sense of oscillators means that one oscillator can push the timing of another oscillator around, but not really turn that oscillator on or off. Okay, now again, one certainly doesn't expect when one takes out a really disgusting goopy nervous system and sticks it under your microscope that things are going to be strictly comply with any particular limit. But as often happens, I think, in physics, you get things that, you get formalisms that are only hold in some very idealized conditions, but then you find out that when you pull very, very far away from these idealized conditions that things still work pretty well. And I think it's in that spirit that there's sort of, over the last sort of many years, there's been a sort of a set of data, of measurements on real nervous systems that has evolved that can be understood in sort of this weak coupling limit. Okay. So much of the material I'm going to talk is actually the result of a collaboration with there's a mathematician named Bart Ehrmantraut, who, if any of you met, is one of the funnier, although slightly psychotic people you've ever dealt with, And so it's sort of a mixture of theory and experiment from a number of labs, including my own. I'll try to identify various people. So I was trying to meet David's challenge of sort of trying to focus on one area where I think sort of theoretical insights and sort of physical measurements and nervous systems kind of met. And it's interesting because in a couple of cases, really, the theory kind of predated the experiment, which is kind of rare, right? Okay, no offense. Okay, so let me just remind everybody how an action potential works. It was this goes back 50 years ago. It's a very simple experiment. You take a nerve cell, which doesn't exactly look like a bowling ball, but for our purposes, we'll make it look like one. We come in with an electrode, and we can inject current into the cell. We come with another electrode, and we can measure the voltage from the cell. Okay. And what you find, what was seen early on by Kenneth Cole, is that if we inject current, and we inject a little bit of current, okay, and we look at the voltage, okay, the cell, again versus time, is goes up very slowly, and as the current dies away, it goes down. And it's very, very boring. Just a capacitor and a resistor, it looks like. But in fact, if we keep on stepping up the voltage, and you step it up to some level above some critical voltage, and what you find is that the cell starts to depolarize, and then all of a sudden it just explodes with activity. And this explosion takes place on a time scale which is about 100 microseconds, about 10 to the minus 4 seconds. And then this explosion sort of slowly decays in time, and turns off, and this decay happens on sort of a much slower time scale. It happens on the order of about 10 to the minus 3 seconds. So this is sort of this is very much a nonlinear phenomena. This phenomena happens because you have ion channels that behave very much like field effect transistors. There's a probability of a channel opening as a function of voltage, and it's the channel is off and off and off, and finally past some critical voltage or some current times resistance of the cell, this channel will start to open up and the system will go into positive feedback. Okay. Now on the one hand, what was done is that you could write down all the currents that go into the cell itself. Okay, you can all the currents that are there are some currents for specific ions. These currents are voltage dependent, so this would be some average value times some probability of being open as a function of voltage, and this may even have a time dependence. Right, I think this morning Jose Onacek talked about protein folding, but not only do proteins fold, but often if you snap them into one state, they'll slowly relax to another state. In the case of ion channels, they'll snap into an open state, relax into a closed state, and then this would also be times some, say, driving force times some synaptic reversal potential. So for any given cell, very many currents, very many ions could be involved, and very rapidly this picture develops into some dynamics that has anywhere from maybe four dynamic variables, voltage, plus lots of underlying variables within the ion channels, into something that maybe has on the order of 23 for some of the cells that are sitting in your cortex and allowing you to listen to the talk. Okay, but I think sort of there was this sort of spirit early on that started with a number of people. John Rintzel in particular is the one that comes to mind in the early 70s that tried to simplify this picture and get it down to two variables. And it's sort of in this spirit that I'm going to attack networks. And you could already see it if you just look at the action, very weird looking action potential itself. Right, the decay time is about an order of magnitude slower than the rise time. So the problem just breaks into fast currents and slow currents. So I could lump all the fast currents together, and I could lump all the slow currents together. So there's sort of an instantaneous time scale. And in the spirit of that picture, I can draw sort of an IV relationship for a cell once I split it into fast and slow currents, and I get a relationship that kind of, and this needs a much steeper slope, looks something like this. And now you could, without doing the actual math, but just bringing this picture, you could kind of see what's happening. The cell sits here at some equilibrium point, which corresponds to here. I start to increase the current. If the current goes up just a little bit, the cell depolarizes a little bit, it goes back down. Nothing interesting happens. If I go past some critical current, which is shown here, all of a sudden the voltage of the cell is going up and up and up, jumps to this point. Even if I relax the current, which in this picture would have been even if I put a step in, which was, say, cut off at this point, I would just hang at the second stable equilibrium point, right? Stable on the time scale of this 10 to the minus 3 seconds. Okay. So early on, there was sort of this flavor that even if you have very complicated dynamics, you could take this potentially very high dimensional system and reduce it down to something like two dimensions, like a fast variable and a slow variable, and then get an awful lot of insight to the way cells work, to their stability, to sort of phenomena that aren't very obvious. Like you could hyperpolarize cells, you could try to turn them off and they'll spring back and overshoot. And this was kind of a success story. So it's within this spirit that I want to try to suggest some work which has gone sort of the next step, to take very many neurons and put them together in a way that we could trace back to the biophysics. And we could always, in principle, work our way back to the biophysics of an individual cell and yet establish the properties of kind of networks. Okay, so now, in a way, you might say the talk begins. Okay, so. Okay, any questions on, okay, that's all of, you know, neuroscience 101 or something in a minute. Okay, so. Is what I'll try to talk about today. So I want to talk about systems, real networks, real biological networks. Ah, okay. In which experimentally one sees electrical wave, electrical activity which appears as traveling waves. So these could be either plane waves or these could be rotating waves. Sort of all the generic features you might expect from sort of, you know, simple nonlinear dynamics. And what I hope to convince you of is that this idea of what I call phase models of oscillators that we can reduce down, as I'll show you, to a single variable is a way that actually is a formalism that actually describes in sort of a semi-quantitative way a lot of the experimental evidence, and even in a number of cases suggested new experiments and the results of new experiments. And first I'm going to just go through and review experimental data that suggests that this, in a qualitative way, that the approach was valid. Then I'm just sort of going to sketch a little bit of the mathematics that involved. I'm going to try to sketch this in pictures. Then I'm going to talk about some comparisons between theoretical predictions and data. Okay, and if we're still awake at the end, I'll show some pretty pictures of spirals that we had a lot of fun measuring in the lab. Okay, so what are some of the signatures that we're looking at? So I mentioned one, it's this idea that we need to identify, first of all, nervous systems that somehow are producing oscillatory output. Okay, now it just turns out that many of the activities you do during the day, you know, breathing and walking and many motor controls are all sort of intrinsically rhythmic. So there are circuits that are just set up that are already producing oscillatory output. So we sort of have this signature to tap into. So it's not only important from a theoretical point of view, but as far as going into the laboratory, you could think of having these narrow band signals that you could actually go into and get a reference signal and identify all the underlying neurons because you have a clean reference signal. So they've been attacked very hard experimentally. And we were going to look in the limit that as a signature, we're interested in systems where the output of one oscillator affects the timing, but not very much the number of spikes or the fact that a cell is spiking at all. Okay? We know something that if we look at systems that are effectively one-dimensional, okay, that if the interactions, right, which means that the length of the axons from one cell, which are producing the output of one cell, okay, and the dendrites of another cell, the part of the cell that's receiving the input, that sort of combined length is small compared to the system. And if that's true, then we, in one dimension, we expect to see things like traveling waves. And in two dimensions, we expect to possibly see the possibility of sort of rotating waves and self-sustained rotating waves. So these are sort of signatures. And the other thing to keep in mind is that that's really so much, it's probably the way you already think in physics, but when we talk about one neuron affecting another, I drew on the board before a picture where we injected only positive current, and the effect of that current was to try to turn the cell on. Okay, nature provides both signs, and one cell could try to turn the cell off as well as try to turn the cell on. Just a statement that there are ionic gradients that are arranged in a way that pull you away from the threshold of firing an action potential as well as push you towards firing an action potential. Okay, but because we're dealing in oscillators, the sign is not enough. The issue of time delay also comes in. So if we're, you know, it depends on the details, but if we're, say, a quarter of a cycle, we have a time delay which is maybe a quarter of a period or half a period away from our neighbor. What you may think is an excitatory connection is actually one that tends to desynchronize you, tending to have the two oscillators go out of phase. So you have to think of time delays as well as signs. Okay, so these are some of the experimental signatures to keep in mind. And then just sort of very quickly, just to sort of sketch the kind of systems we're thinking about in terms of architecture we want to look for experimentally is we could think of systems that have a single architecture and directed connections. And if you were to look at them, you would think you have a wave, right? So I guess there's not so many movie theaters. All the N-plexes are prone not to have light bulbs go around their marquees. But if you were to go to at least one theater left in San Diego, there is a marquee. And basically what happens is you have a single oscillator and just a series of delay lines that go to different light bulbs. So it's apparent motion. But it's for our purposes, it's really a trivial example. The kind of system that we're interested in is one in which each of the individual neurons, or at least clusters of individual neurons, could act as oscillators, okay? And there's connections between these individual oscillators. And sort of depending on the nature of these interactions between oscillators. Okay, and I've drawn this solely for a one-dimensional case. You may or may not pick up some interesting timing differences. So we're looking in the limit where we have an architecture which are individual oscillators which are connected in one or two or three dimensions. Okay, and the essence of the problem is really going to define how what I'll talk about the phases of these oscillators interact. Okay, so that's sort of the sketch. Okay, but so now we have to understand a little bit what we mean by phase. Okay, so I've shown on top, okay, is in the dark curve is a picture of a cell which is firing an action potential. It was what I tried to draw on the board before. Okay, and it's the voltage is going up, rising very quickly and slowly decaying down. This is a sort of a reduced, a two-dimensional version of a real cell. But let's see what's happening. Okay, the real cell may have a very high number of underlying degrees of dynamical variables. Like I said, there are cells in your cortex for which one can cleanly identify, you know, 20, 23 parameters. But if the cell is oscillating, right, it's making this trajectory that's going through this very, very high dimensional space, and then the trajectory can close. So it's sort of like being on a roller coaster, right? You're going through this high dimensional space and you're coming back, and you're going through this high dimensional space and you're coming back. And as long as all I care about is the oscillatory motion, I could just think of going with a paintbrush and making little ticks on the track, right? And there's really only one variable now, which is how far you are along the track. Okay, so that variable is obviously just the phase variable, which I've shown just in two dimensions. So every time you go, you know, hyperpolarized, depolarized, fire, back down again, up and down again, you're just going round and round in some kind of circle, or round and round in some kind of trajectory. So if I have an oscillatory system, and I agree that they're going to interact in a way which I'm not going to distort, okay, this limit cycle, which is strictly what the idea of weak coupling means, then I could deal with a single dynamical variable, that somehow I could take this 23 or high dimensional system and crunch it down to one degree of freedom. Okay, that's great, but now again you have to ask why is this help? And in particular talking about neurons that interact, oscillators that interact. How do I turn this picture into one that allows me to describe interactions? Okay. Well, this was a program put forth by Kuramoto's group in Japan in the late 70s and early 80s. And it was only in the last couple of years adopted into neuroscience, but it's been very, very successful in many areas of physical science. And the idea is that I want to take a physical perturbation, like the injection of current into one cell by neighboring cell, and turn that physical interaction into a shift in phase. Okay, and I think, let me just try to capture in this, my first attempt at not quite PowerPoint, the basic idea. Okay, it's a little fuzzy, but that's okay. Okay, so this is the idea. The blue curve represents just the limit cycle, the path that this neuron is undergoing as it just goes through this space. And obviously, I can only draw in two dimensions. Okay. Now, suppose I come in with some kind of perturbation. The perturbation could just be I'm injecting a little current based on the output of another cell. Okay. What happens is suppose I'm at this point in my limit cycle. Okay. My perturbation, say if this is the voltage axis, I'm injected a little bit of current, would be to push the system a little bit away from the original limit cycle. Okay. So I do that. And then I let it go, okay? So the system then just tries, you know, in the limit that the perturbation is weak and all the kind of usual limits you'd have, okay? In fact, the system will now just oscillate and it'll gradually sort of hone in and try to reestablish itself along the original limit cycle path, right? It'll try to converge to the original path. So I've taken a physical perturbation and let the system go, and it just slowly tries to recover to the original path. Okay. Now suppose at the same time as an experiment, I just kept track, okay, of a point on the original limit cycle, right, on the unperturbed limit cycle, and I let that system run. Okay. After a very long period of time, when the perturbed system has recovered, there's going to be potentially some timing difference between the unperturbed system and the perturbed system. So the effect of this perturbation And the effect of the sensitivity of the limit cycle to this perturbation has been to cause a phase shift, okay, between where this oscillator would have been before I perturbed it or without the perturbation versus with the perturbation. Okay, so that's the underlying essence. That's the underlying physics of this sort of phase interaction. That you could turn a real physical perturbation, which has to do with, say, injecting currents, or it could do with injecting any ion, which is sort of a state variable for the system, turning this into a timing difference. Okay. So. Now, strictly speaking, the kind of mathematics that leads to this is only valid in the limit of infinite time, in the limit of perfectly closed orbits, in the limit of weak perturbations. Okay, but it just will turn out when you sort of do numerical simulations based on realistic systems that you find out as well. You know, maybe you could kick the system by 20%, and maybe it recovers in two cycles instead of an infinite number of cycles. And it's actually one of those cases where it turns out that the idealizations actually don't hurt you when you try to apply this to more realistic systems. Okay, so this is the idea. So we want to see if there's biological evidence that supports this picture. Okay, any questions? Okay, so now we sort of take off our theory hats, so to speak, and we put on our experimental hats, which I'm much more comfortable with, to say the least. Okay, so as I mentioned, you know, rhythmic output is a common signature of many systems, and I'm going to present some data that suggests that rhythmic output in one area can affect the timing, but not the rate of spiking or the probability of spiking in another area. And I think the lesson that's going to come from the data is that traveling waves, either fronts or rotating waves, are typically present outside a period of stimulation, just when I'm attending to the world to see if there's input coming in. But the minute input comes in, synchrony, which means everybody going up and down at once, is going to dominate. So I'm going to see some kind of switch in my pattern. So this is sort of to summarize the data. Okay, so there are examples from a number of critters, and I'm going to talk about two experiments. Okay, one has to do with the olfactory system in a mollusk. This is a garden snail. It's the thing that destroys your tomatoes. And the other is somewhat more trendy in the neuroscience field because it involves a mammal. I mean, we are funded by the National Institutes of Health, emphasis on health, not garden slugs. Okay. And this comes from mostly Wolf Singer's lab in Germany. Okay, so let's start at the beginning. Here's our subject, or as my colleague Pat Diamond says, a poor defenseless animal. Okay. This is a garden slug heading up a mushroom, and you see two large protuberances on top and two smaller protuberances on the top. Okay, the smaller protuberances are essentially acting as a mouth. It's a chemoreceptor. And the two large protuberances on top have an epithelial layer, right? That molecules, that odorant molecules combine to, and they have cells that will put out spikes, put out action potentials if the right odorant molecules bind to those receptors. Okay, there's also a very crude lens at the top of the two tentacles. It's enough so the animal could sort of see light and dark. Okay. But this animal has no auditory system. This animal sees the world. Its worldview is predominantly shaped by olfaction. It could home based on olfaction. It could search for food based on olfaction. And to some extent, you can do single trial learning with this animal based on olfaction, just like in people. Right? It's quite remarkable. Okay. Now, what's actually interesting is if we look at the nervous system in this animal. Okay. So this is the slightly psychedelic picture. Okay. Is that the nervous system of this garden slug consists of a single group of neurons, or it's called ganglion. Okay, if you look in your brainstem, right, the part that doesn't get much attention, but the part of your body that controls breathing and chewing and you know all the more fundamental functions rather than doing calculations. Okay, you see the neurons are just grouped into neurons are clustered into ganglia. So this animal has one main ganglia with about 10 to the 4 neurons. And what's sort of quite fascinating, it has these two lobes to the side that get direct inputs, okay, from this, from the nose, from the tentacle. And these two areas each have about 10 to the 5 neurons. So this is the nervous system of this animal, by an order of magnitude, is dominated by olfactory input. And what sort of, just in words, if you were to actually section and do anatomy, and there was a fellow named Ron Chase up in Montreal who's done beautiful anatomy on this preparation, is you find that the neurons have an arborization, right, an extent of dendrites and axons that's running about 1/5 of the total size of this olfactory organ, olfactory cortex. So this structure is about 500 microns, right, looks very big under the microscope. Okay, and there's about 100 microns of total length. So in some sense, there's short-range connections. Okay, so that's sort of one, fulfilled one criteria. The anatomy looks good. Okay, the next thing that happened is there was a wonderful experiment done by Palapan Balaban. That's a funny name. Okay, which keep in mind that this animal is a squishy, right? No skull. Okay, it's hard to put this in stereotaxic device, right? And what Balaban was able to do is to put a wire inside this olfactory organ, okay, and sew up the animal, which actually is no trivial feat for an animal without a bone, okay? And it's also an animal that they slime, right? Everybody knows that slugs slime. You pick up an animal, you start with an 8-gram animal, by the time you're done with it, it's lost half its body weight due to slime, okay? You put a wire in the animal and had the animal roam around in a cage with a number of food sources. And what he observed, in fact, was that the olfactory system was putting out regular pulses at around 0.7 hertz or 0.6 hertz. So this was an animal that oscillated, and it had an olfactory system that oscillated, you know, during a real olfactory task, a real sort of search task for food. Okay. So this is already looking good. It oscillates. It has short-range connections. If you now isolate the olfactory system from that animal, okay, so you no longer have an 8-gram slug, but you now have sort of a half a gram nervous system sitting on something like a 500 kilogram air table. Okay, what you find is that there's two classes of neurons. It's a rarity among nervous systems in its simplicity. And there's a group of cells in this nervous system that are just sitting here, the ones marked bursting, which are just putting out big bursts of action potentials and turning off, and big bursts of action potentials and turning off. Okay, so we see just sitting there in its ground state, so to speak, it's acting as a rhythmic oscillator. Okay, and it's acting as a rhythmic oscillator with two cell types that we could hope to understand the biophysics of. Okay. So what happens? So the obvious thing to do then is to look at the spatial extent in this prep. It satisfies all these different criteria wrote down for a system that, just based on very simple physical ideas of weakly interacting oscillators with short-range connections, we would have thought that this creature would actually be putting out electrical waves. Okay, so this was, as they say at the NIH, this was our hypothesis. Okay, and lo and behold, this is what we do. We isolate the olfactory bulbs. We put on, the olfactory cortex. In order to look at many sites at once, rather than trying to put very many wires in, okay, we use a technology which was invented by a colleague of mine, Larry Cohn, back in the mid-1970s, and we put a dye on the cells that goes partially through the membranes, okay, and that dye undergoes a Stark shift as the electric field across the membrane changes. So we get about a part in 1,000 or maybe a part in 10,000 change in optical signal, but that's well within our sensitivity, okay. And what we've done is the change in intensity of fluorescent light coming back is now dependent on the voltage across the cell. So that's our contrast mechanism. And we just take snapshots of this. And here we're taking a snapshot at around every 120 milliseconds or so. And we've candy-colored net depolarization red, and we've candy-colored net hyperpolarization, net on red, net off purple. Okay. And what you could see is happening, just sort of bring it down where I could point, okay, is that there's a band of depolarization that starts up at one end, and just as time goes by, just sweeps. So you can just sit there, and it's just going whoosh, 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 okay, and it's pretty wild, okay? And It's also essentially one-dimensional motion, because if I look across the band, as I've done just by putting little boxes, the round box and the square box, things are essentially in time. But if I look from front to back, things are sort of out of phase. This could be shown here. Okay. So what we've learned from this, okay, is in fact we do see this wave motion. And there's just one more interesting thing which we'll get back to, one more sort of fact. And that's what happens when we put an odorant on. Okay. So these pictures here are similar to the pictures I showed you before. They're little snapshots at the top of this olfactory cortex. And you can see, just as I showed you before, those little bands of excitation that are running across the preparation. Okay, so in this preparation, kind of like in Woody Allen's movie Sleeper, right? We just have an isolated nose. You know, sort of a funny prep now. I'm showing my age. Anybody see Sleeper? Famous for a Volkswagen that starts after 5,000 years in a cave. We have a little cantilever, right? Sort of like the Frank Lloyd Wright rendition of neuroscience. And we have the olfactory cortex is on the bottom. It's pinned onto the bottom. We have some objectors looking from below, some water immersion objectors looking from below. And then we have an olfactory nerve that comes around the front. And we have a little nose that sits on top where we could keep it nice and dry and puff odor on. And the key thing I just want to mention is that while in the absence of an odorant, we just see running waves, when we put on an odorant here, which is essentially essence of potato odor, okay, then you find out that there's just at about the time where the odorant is peaking, the entire olfactory cortex all of a sudden becomes synchronous, momentarily synchronous, or the wavelength, you might say, goes almost to infinity. Okay, and then it recovers and we pick up this banding structure again. Okay, so in addition to seeing traveling waves, we also see a change in the wavelength of these traveling waves upon stimulation. Okay, so this is a bit of phenomenology, but it has many of the flavors, right, that we expected for, at least qualitatively, from this phase model. And again, the lesson was that the background activity is synonymous with traveling waves, and the sensory stimulus is synonymous with synchrony. Okay.
So I'm just curious, how many cells are involved?
Okay, so there's about 10,000 cells in the lobe, and I think maybe the more relevant thing is I didn't bring the data with me, but we look sort of at a correlation volume, in the sense of asking how many cells are doing. Well, the same thing up to some correlation length, and that was about 100 cells, right? So it seemed that there were on the order of like 100. You could break the lobe up into 100 little pieces, okay? But some of them are in the same line, so they were synchronized. So it seemed that you had about 10 correlation lengths, and that compared with about 5 synaptic lengths. So five arborization lengths. I'm sure somebody's model will explain the factor of two, but the numbers came out about right. Yeah.
Okay. When you say that
there was a traveling length, but all the cells in the state were traveling, or did some cells that were participating, and then when you excited, they all just suddenly started to become active? No. Again, I didn't. Okay. I only brought some sort of key pieces of data, but there's a group of cells that are capable of putting out electrical bursts, and every such the way you actually make these measurements is quite amazing. Nairn Sacklin got the Nobel Prize for showing that if you take a tube of glass and suck onto a neuron, right, it actually sticks. It's still one of the unexplained mysteries of biophysics. But this allows you to actually probe the voltage of a cell. So we use this patch clamp technique. We never saw a cell that had this sort of behavior, which we have a reference, which is the overall electrical activity of the preparation. It's called a field potential. It's a fancy name for sticking a wire in the middle of the preparation. And in fact, cells that have this kind of behavior, sort of bump, 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 right, always had this burst. So it just was actually changing the relative timing of these bursts, when the order went on. It's not something trivial like we're just adding another population on top. And because the optical signal, right, clearly has very many cells that contribute to each pixel. But it's not like the amplitude went up and the timing changed, right? The amplitude of the signal stays about the same. Okay, you can kind of see it from the picture. It's the same color scale, unchanged, right? Okay. Okay, any other?
Was it correct that there were three successive growths in each? There were three spikes in one?
Yeah.
So is this from a single cell or from?
No, that's one cell. That's
one cell, and it makes these three spikes.
But that's I don't want to say that's typical, but there's very many examples of neurons that, you know, there's clearly a second time, right, in this kind of cell. So often what will happen is the cell will start to fire. It's probably what happens in this cell. The cell gets depolarized, it would start to fire, and then there's a slow turn-off mechanism. And in this cell, it's because calcium comes into the cell with every spike. There's a channel that lets calcium in when the voltage is about this high. And then there's a channel that conducts potassium ions, which has a very low, right, and it's different channels, right. So it's more than just Hodgkin-Huxley here. Yeah. Okay. Okay, any other? Okay, maybe we have time to
understand why you need the oscillations to smell.
No. Okay. But I could offer a conjecture at the end. Okay, why this is good. Okay. What? I was going to get back to these guys because there's some data we took which actually explains why the waves moved in a certain direction. I just sort of wanted to tempt you with your appetite. Okay. Okay, but I'll get back to that point at the end. Okay. Okay, so I just wanted to make another example, just to, you might say, oh, this isn't a garden slug, and I mean, the NIH doesn't care about garden slugs anyway, so give me a real animal and show me that these ideas really make sense in terms of real animals. So there was a body of work that, in some sense, started with Bouyer's experiments in around 1980, but really sort of came into their own in the last decade with experiments from Will Singren. Let me just try to sketch the essence of this experiment, which is in this flavor of phase oscillators. And this is the following observation. You take a mammal, and the favorite mammal in this case is the cat, and you can put many electrodes on the surface of the cat. Okay, so of course the visual system of the cat. And the cat's in a box. And it's just, you know, cats are not very smart animals. If you have a cat, they just say, open that can, and otherwise they sleep. And but the cat's in the box, and it was actually a very cute experiment. They had a window, and they had a screen in the window, and then the other side of the window was a mouse. Okay, and all of a sudden, whoosh, the screen opens up, okay, and the cat is looking at the mouse, and the cat just immediately goes up on his haunches. Who knows what's happening to the mouse, okay? But what happened during that period, in fact, this period of attention, is that what was a lot of sort of low frequency cortical activity, whose origin is not one, there's no point even discussing because you're not quite sure what's going on. All of a sudden, this cat started putting out sort of spatially coherent electrical activity that was running between about 30 and 50 hertz. And it's shown here by this bump at 40 hertz. Okay? This is a story that sort of took on a life of its own. Francis Crick thinks this is the essence of consciousness, but I'll just keep to more mundane issues. This issue was looked at again about 10 years later by Charlie Gray as a postdoc. And he recorded from individual neurons within the visual system of the cat in an anesthetized animal under pretty tightly controlled circumstances. Okay, The anesthesia may have cost them the ability to look at certain phenomena, but what it did allow them to do in this case was really to look at the spiking rate from individual neurons. And it turns out the spikes are tended to be bunched, and they tend to occur sort of in packets with sort of a underlying 40 hertz rhythm. So a little bit like I showed you in the case of the olfactory system, in fact, the cortex itself is picking up its own frequency, right? And it's, and the presence of visual stimulation, okay, causes a neuron to start to spike. Visual stimulus is starting about here, pulses per second, that's the spike rate. And if you actually look in detail, okay, at these signals, you find out they tend to be bunched. Okay, what's very interesting, if you look back at data that was published even 10 years before this, you also see that the spikes are bunched, which is a famous lesson in physics, is that you should understand your noise, because this really could have been reported by people 10 years earlier if they trusted their measurements. Okay. And now, why is this interesting from the point of view of phase oscillators? What's the lesson to be learned? So I'm just going to jump to data that's shown on the bottom row. And let me describe the following. It was found out sort of very early on in the 60s by Hubel and Wiesel, sort of based on work by Mountcastle and the somatosensory system, that there are parts, when signals go sort of through about four synapses and get to your visual cortex, a part of the visual field that's here maps on to one part of the primary visual cortex, and a part of the visual field that's someplace else maps on to a different part. Okay, so the inputs are segregated, and the inputs actually follow sort of a rough map of the two-dimensional world, right, of this sort of angular, you know, r theta world in front of you. Now, that's actually very nice, because in principle, you have the ability to stimulate two different areas, right? So there's a name, these are called a classical receptive field. And if I wiggle a stimulus like this, there's a part of my brain that becomes particularly well activated. And then sort of the rest of my visual cortex is just sort of some very low level activation. Okay. What Charlie Gray did, what he would put on a stimulus in this part of the visual field. Okay, the stimulus was a bar. This is a moving bar. This is particularly well adapted towards exciting cells in your visual cortex. And he'd look at, and he'd show that the neuron started to fire, and what's plotted over here in their data is just the autocorrelation function. So you can see the neuron starts to fire, and it's kind of wiggly up and wiggly down. So it means it's firing and it's oscillating with this period, which is about 25 milliseconds or so, okay, about 40 hertz. And then if I put a stimulus on over here and start to move it, okay, again, neurons in a different part of the visual cortex start to fire, and they also oscillate with about the same frequency, maybe not exactly the same frequency. Now, if the cells happen to be excited at the same time, but they're excited in a way that's very different, like one bar moving this way at the same time another bar moves this way, or some sort of incommensurate motion. In fact, the neurons will become excited, they'll oscillate very nicely, but their cross-correlation, right, the tendency of the timing of one cell to fire another will be flat, will be zero, okay, if you subtract out the baseline. Okay, so they're not interacting at all. On the other hand, if you take, just to jump to the extreme example, which is shown in their column 3, now I put a stimulus on which actually excites both regions at the same time. So that being both cortical regions are being activated in a commensurate manner, what I find is that the cells have about the same autocorrelation function as they had originally. It's kind of really, the modulation depth doesn't really change very much. But in fact, all of a sudden now I pick up a substantial cross-correlation. So I think this just gets back to our point that even now we see in visual cortex, we've activated cells. If they're activated, there's some property of the stimulus such that if we co-activate them in a similar manner, they tend to spike together. Their timing is changed, okay? But the number of spikes per second is essentially unaffected. Okay, so it's this idea that you could affect the timing of cells without affecting the rate of spiking. Okay, so this again, you just look at this and this smells very much like a phase model. Okay. But everything here, you may notice, if you look at this trace, this is the cross correlation, and it's peaking about equal time. It's synchronous. And you say, wait, but I look at the visual system and I know, in fact, that again the arborization lengths of the cells in some sense small. may be very small compared to the total size of the system. You know, you just poke a developmental biologist and they'll tell you that the connections have to be localized. You poke a theorist in developmental biology, they tell you the connections have to be localized, okay? So you can't have both. Okay, so again, this was an interesting issue, and it's one where really, so the technical matters, technical issues mattered very much. So there was a very recent experiment, a relatively recent experiment, also from the same lab by Peter Relsema. And in this case, very much like in the LIMAX, they now had a cat, but this was an awake cat, not an anesthetized cat. And this cat had to attend to a stimulus. And the stimulus was a bar, and the cat would just be looking, and the bar would pop on, and the cat would start to attend to the stimulus, and then the bar would rotate. This is about the most sophisticated thing you could teach a cat. And the minute the bar would rotate, the cat would have to take his paw and push a lever. There was a hard experiment, lots of embedded wires, lots of training. Only 2 out of 5 cats actually could learn the task. You needed to pair it with the sound of a can opener or something, like a can opener. What in fact happened here is that if you look at periods outside of stimulation, like say where those double dots are, what's plotted here is the cross-correlation between two areas in the visual motor system versus time. So you're just sort of looking at little slices of correlation, of cross-correlations put up on edge as a function of time. So when the color is red, it means it's peaking. When the color is green, it means you're in a trough. And then there's a little black line, which is the zero time. And right when the cat is outside this point where it's attending to a single stimulus, in fact, you see timing differences between two parts of the visual system. So I think this is, the lesson here is that when you look carefully, what you see is that background activity leads to waves, which is very clear for the case of LIMAX, where you could image everything. And it looks like it's a growing story in the cat, or at least you've measured at a few points, that when there's a sensory stimulus on, both in the cat and the LIMAX and a lot of other systems I haven't described yet, you see stimulus, you see synchrony. And the whole idea is that you have co-activated areas. And what you're doing is one area is not pushing the rate of spiking around, but it's pushing the timing around. Okay, so this is kind of the data, and just looking at the data, it kind of smells of coupled oscillators. Okay, so now, if you believe this, we can try to sort of put these two stories together for a couple of cases. Okay, any questions? Okay, so we have about 10 minutes. Okay, I'll just kind of cruise. Okay, so I want to describe three, or maybe I'll describe two of these. Okay. Let's just go back to the idea of how to establish, okay, this phase model in the first place, both from a theoretical point of view and what kind of measurements we can make to test this. Okay, so if we remember from the picture at the beginning, we had this idea that we had a limit cycle, and we were running around the limit cycle. And this limit cycle could be in a very high dimensional space of all the parameters for the neurons. But then we could perturb the limit cycle, okay? And we're really trying to turn this perturbation into a phase shift. So this perturbation depends on two parts. We need to know how sensitive the limit cycle is there to the outside world. Like it could be a part where just physically you're done, you've just fired an action potential, your membrane is extremely leaky, you're trying to push it with current, but it's very, very weak, you're very insensitive. It could be a part of the cycle where all your channels, every possible channel that can be closed is closed, so you inject current, your resistance is as high as possible, and you're most sensitive. So what you care about on the limit cycle is not the shape of the limit cycle, per se, but you really care about how sensitive that limit cycle is to a perturbation in any of its state variables. And you could imagine very much that if you have a model for the underlying biophysics, you can compute that sensitivity, okay, for each parameter. Like you can compute, you know, how much the phase would change for a given change of voltage, how much the phase would change for a given change in a channel activation parameter. So this sensitivity goes right back to the underlying biophysics. And the perturbation itself, we'll see, goes back to the biophysics. Okay, so. But what happens here is that, as I said, the real system has very many variables, dV, dt, the activation parameter, dt, etc. Okay, and we're really interested in turning this into a single variable, the phase, and looking at this interaction term, which has to do with the sensitivity, which just tends to be called Z in the literature, and a perturbation, which is called P. Okay, now, what's really a dot product among perturbations among all the different axes becomes very simple if I just have neurons that interact via synapses, because the first approximation, I'm only affecting the voltage in the cell. I'm just injecting current and affecting the voltage in the cell. So, it was a very nice experiment that was done by Alex Reyes. It was done for different purposes, but he looked at motor neurons in cortex. So I'll sort of skip all those details, but we understand motor neurons pretty well, and we could make a model of the individual motor neurons. This is a model that had about 11 parameters. I'm not going to pretend for... We understand the kinetic variables with high accuracy, but things like the density of channels, there's no pretension that you know, one knows that better than sort of factors of two. But what you can calculate, in fact, is how sensitive the timing is when you go to perturb the cell. So here's the action potential. If I try to perturb it right after the action potential, I really can't shift the phase very much. Right, the cell is recovering, and physically it's kind of leaky. Calcium has entered the cell. It hasn't quite been buffered yet. A number of things are going on. Gradually, in fact, if I now look at the period before the action potential, my sensitivity is just going up and up and up and up. More of the channels are closed. I'm really primed. When I get too close to my action potential, I'm starting to depolarize and open up channels. So again, my impedance drops, and I again become somewhat insensitive. So I get this very sort of stereotypic curve for this type of cell for how sensitive I am. This is the phase sensitivity that goes into our calculations. Now that's all great, but you could actually measure that directly, as it was done first by Alex Reyes as a graduate student. And what Alex did was very simple. He just took a cell, injected some current, measured how long it took for the cell to produce an action potential when it was just firing. And then he would go in and inject a little current. For technical reasons, he injected a little current that looked like the kind of postsynaptic potential the cell normally gets. It's not really important here. But what he found is this is right after the action potential, and this is right before the action potential. And then he asked what the probability of firing is, and he got a curve, right, which essentially just is a timing advancement curve. So we just quietly lift Alex's points, and we find that the value of this phase sensitivity from measurement matches very, very well with the value that you calculate from the underlying biophysics. So I think the point is that this sort of essential parameter that you put into this kind of phase model to connect it with the biophysics can be done sort of from scratch in a sort of ab initio way, or it also could be measured directly, right, if you didn't sort of know all the underlying details. Okay, so how do we go on? So we just take that as a starting point, okay? And we're interested now in this, the interaction where, again, it's slow, so we average over a cycle, we average over theta, sketching over a lot of details. But we really care about the dot product of the sensitivity, Z, and this perturbation, what I call P, and we can put in the biophysics of this perturbation. What does a synapse mean? It means the presynaptic cell, the neighboring cell, fires an action potential. So I care about the activation of the neighboring cell, which is what I call S. And then I care about the response of the postsynaptic cell. So I care about the voltage of the postsynaptic cell relative to some battery, the thing that pushes current through the synapses. So again, I have a well-defined form. Okay, so I sort of know what this activation term looks like. I'm really sort of asking for the synapse to turn on. I know this from the biophysics. We've already talked about the phase sensitivity. And then what I find is that when I look at this integral, it has sort of terms, sensitivity terms, response terms that all cluster together. So I have a term that depends only on the postsynaptic cell, and I have a term that depends only on the presynaptic cell. So life is beginning to look simple, right? And each of these terms goes back to the biophysics. And then just to put it all together, I have two terms, a presynaptic activation and a postsynaptic response. And the only thing I care about is an integral that turns out to look like the correlation between these two terms. So that's really very nice, because these are observables in the laboratory. This is the output of an electrode. This is the output of an electrode, okay? And I can understand the interaction for the phase model in terms of two measurements, and I get a predicted form, okay? So this hasn't been measured yet, but I'm sort of pushing various, trying to push various sundry graduate students in this direction, okay? Now, what happens, you could look at this, and it's a little bit ugly, it's hard to understand. It tells you how the phase of this cell is changed, the postsynaptic cell is changed when there's activity in the presynaptic cell. But there's a nice way to understand this, and just sketch this. What we could do is we could set up a little model system where I have two cells. I didn't draw this here. This would just be the presynaptic. We no longer have a presynaptic cell and a postsynaptic cell. We just have two cells in a symmetric situation, each affecting the other, okay? And basically, what I write down is a little phase equation for each cell, right? The change in the phase of the presynaptic cell and a change in the phase of the postsynaptic cell. And these are just the odd counterparts of each other, okay? So in fact, what I end up with is an equation for the phase difference between these two cells, which again is just, you know, the thing that you report experimentally, and it looks like the odd part of this interaction. And this is kind of the pretty thing, because I can make a graph of this, okay? And then I could ask this, the odd part will actually cross the axis, and it must cross the axis at zero, it must cross the axis at plus minus pi, and I could ask, when is this system stable? And in order to be stable, I need the time derivative to become smaller, right, as the phase difference increases. And there's actually two, in this particular example, which is from a realistic motor neuron, as you've seen, there's actually two stable points, and they're both away from a phase shift of zero. Okay, so I use this as a nice example because it's showing that this is kind of the underlying mechanism that could give rise to traveling waves, that these pair of cells will pick up a phase shift. You know, it's just a pair, and it's symmetric, so whether it's plus or minus, of course, depends on the initial conditions. But now you can imagine something to break the symmetry and link these, okay, and all of a sudden get traveling waves. Okay, so let's just actually use this as an example. So I describe how you can find the phase sensitivity, and I showed measurements of Alex rays to get experimental verification of this. Let's look back at our friend the LIMAX and see if we could understand how this system gets the direction of its waves. Okay, so we talked before, just to remind everybody, we had an experimental system where the red bands were depolarization, and the depolarization was running in a given direction. So we need to do a little homework exercise first. Let's just take a two-oscillator system, and just like we had in our little example before, but instead of having two oscillators with exactly the same frequency, we're going to do two oscillators with slightly different frequency. Okay, I mean, this is an old problem. It's in Kuramoto's, you know, 1984 book. So it's no pretense of anything new here. But what's happening physically is that I have two oscillators. If they're running on their own, one's a little bit faster than the other. And then I hook them up with a reciprocal connections. Okay, if the connections are strong enough, they'll frequency lock and they'll phase lock. And they'll phase lock in a way which the oscillator with the higher natural frequency wants to be a little bit phase advanced. Okay? So I could take this basic idea and I could hook it up and in fact, okay, I can make a chain of such oscillators, okay, such that there's a gradient and a range of sort of disorder, this gradient in frequency linearly in X. Okay? And when I do that, okay, so to first approximation, I'm going to get a linear phase gradient or a traveling wave with just a phase that depends solely on distance. So that's the prediction. So how do you test this? Okay? Well, we go to our preparation, okay, and we see the waves are running along a certain axis. So we actually take this in the laboratory. And you make what's called a slice preparation, okay? So you take this prep and you cool it and you sort of stick it up like a little mushroom and then whoosh, right, like sort of off with its head, and you make little slices, okay? And then from each of these little slices, I can measure the average frequency of oscillation in the individual slice. And I can see, in fact, if they're all the same frequency, or there's actually a gradient of frequency. What you find, in fact, is that there's a gradient in the isolated frequency, okay? And as shown by these dots over here, and it's a linear gradient, okay? And we were able to make about 6 or 7 slices off this preparation. It's only 500 microns, so these are sort of 100 micron objects. It's actually a little tricky. And then, of course, what you find is that if we carefully measure the phase gradient, it's this solid line and this dashed line. It's from two different types of measurements. So we find sort of qualitative agreement with our simple model that the animal arranged neurons in a way that left when isolated, okay, they would spike with a gradient of frequency. Together, they fire with one frequency, but now they have a traveling wave. Okay, so I think this is really the kind of experiment which just wouldn't have gotten done if we didn't weren't actually motivated by theory. Okay, I'm gonna just because time is getting tight, I'm gonna just jump a little bit to the end. I just want to say there's a world I haven't talked about. It's the world of lower vertebrates. If you've ever watched a leech or a lamprey, I guess it depends what part of the world you grew up in. They're sort of wiggly animals. They have spinal cords, which have maybe about 20 some odd segments. And this has been another area, mostly due to the work of Nancy Coppell and Bart Ehrmantraut, where sort of these sort of theoretical ideas, phase models ideas, have given people insights, like shown people effectively how many oscillators there were, which have caused people to look at the anatomy to show that there are connections that actually span about 2 or 3 of these individual oscillators and link them as one. Okay. The one thing I alluded to at the beginning and I'll just kind of sketch had to do with rotating waves. So this might be sort of food for thought for people, for theorists. We saw already that in visual cortex, when we looked at awake, trained, behaving animals, there was evidence for timing differences. The experimental challenge is really to look at the timing issues across the entire visual cortice. That hasn't been done in the cat. It has, however, been done in the turtle, as I'll show you in a moment. Okay. The reason for this is solely technical at the moment. But in two dimensions, as opposed to one dimension, there's sort of a difference in the essential physics. And then in two dimensions, you could get a wave without breaking symmetry. It's just become self-sustaining in its own right. And my understanding from Bart Ehrmantraut, who I did a lot of work with, who's a mathematician, is that there's really even no theorem to prove the existence of waves in two dimensions, even though numerically one sees these all the time. Okay, but again, the same sort of phase model very much predicts that when one has coupled oscillators arranged in a two-dimensional sheet, as occurs in your cortex, you should see electrical waves. So how do we actually test for this? Okay, well, this is an experiment that used much of the same technology that was described in the olfactory system for the LIMAX. We have a turtle, and we want to look at large areas. So we again use a molecule whose fluorescence changes with the voltage across the neuron. So using Stark effect as a contrast mechanism. Now, you could say, why not a cat? I mentioned before, these signals are very tiny. They're about a part in 10 to the 4, a part in 10 to the 3. That's, you know, for an animal on a couple of thousand pound air table, that's not a problem. But for an animal that's pumping red blood cells on a couple of thousand pound air tables, you're going to have a very, very expensive measurement of blood flow. So at this time, we needed a preparation in which we can put in sort of our own oxygenated, you know, osmotically correct, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, fluid to replace the blood flow. And this was our friend the turtle. So this guy looked cute. This is out of a little pet magazine before, people discovered that the turtles were giving little kids salmonella. But you put a goldfish in the tank with them, and they are vicious. Right, these animals have extremely strong vision. Okay, they will attack their prey completely based on vision. They're really a vision physiologist's friend. And we're going to look, just to jump to the chase, there's also a well-defined visual cortex. It's the little area that's labeled D2. I didn't invent the names, okay? It's a visual cortex. It's different than your cortex and my cortex because it only has three layers, and probably what happened in evolution is this folded over at some point and formed the modern neocortex. Okay, in fact, if you were to take snapshots of the top of the cortex, okay, as I present the stimulus, you'll see something like this. There's a lot of electrical activity, but most of this electrical activity is in a band. It happens to be about 20 hertz in the turtle as opposed to 40 hertz in the cat. I don't think that's important. But in order to get a picture of what's going on, we take this sort of the signal measured at very many sites. This is about 400 sites across the cortex. Most of the activity is at 18 hertz. We just demodulate this at 18 hertz. And I'm just showing the phase from this demodulation. So this is a series of postage stamps. And let's just look what's happening, say, here or here, where the little star is. You see, roughly, if I look in this direction, you see roughly a gradient of color. So that corresponds to a traveling wave. And now look down here at the double star. We see all the colors come together. And if we very carefully plot the phase, okay, on the first thing, we have phase lines, which are crudely like a linear traveling wave. And by the time we get to the double dots, all of a sudden we see a phase singularity. Okay, so in fact, the kind of picture you get from any of a number of models with interacting neurons, okay, you see during normal vision, you see these phase singularities. Okay, so I'll just conclude. Okay, I didn't talk about computation yet, but I'm sure you'll ask me a question. Saying from the point of view of dynamics, I think we went in with very simple ideas of what short-range connections would do in systems that were able to identify had underlying oscillators, and the oscillators interacted in a weak way. We just kind of used physics as a guide. And the kind of and this physics suggested that we should see electrical waves, traveling waves, plane waves and rotating waves. And in fact, when we look carefully, we do see these waves. And in some cases, we're able to go further and sort of find the underlying mechanism, like frequency gradients. And the one example I showed that drove these waves. So it was sort of a little bit back and forth between sort of the qualitative ideas that came from phase-coupled oscillators and measurements in the laboratory. And you know, I think the next step is, so the theory is sort of, again, jumped well beyond the experiment and suggesting how oscillators can come together and you know, it's when the noise level drops too low or the temperature drops too low, as you might say, all of a sudden coalesce into individual cells could coalesce into oscillators, and how maybe there are one or two hierarchies of oscillating states. The theory's given us a number of ideas for future experiments, which you know, maybe in 5 years' time we'll have something to say. Okay, thank you. Within the same animal, it occurs in the same location. Okay.
Does something happen at the edges of the visual cortex?
Well, let me see if I have the best picture with me. Edges is maybe you get an idea. Edge is a funny. Edge in anatomy is a funny term. There's inputs that come from an area called dorsal. You learn a lot of big words in this field, right? Called dorsal thalamus, right? It goes basically eyeball to thalamus to cortex, right? And there's like three synapses in the eyeball, the retina, right? So we're four synapses away. And these inputs project into this area called D2, and actually the reason this is getting thinner is the projections are springing up and up and up and up and up. But I mean, where does it end? Here. It ends in a soft way, right? So when you actually look at the strength of the signal is completely lost in the demodulated data that I showed you, which is only concerned with how much signal is there at 18 hertz and what its phase is. But if you look at the raw signal, you find it sort of decreases over something on the order of the scale. Right, so something, you know, greater than sort of the technical scale caused by sort of scattering the light within the tissue itself. So it's edges are kind of hard. Yeah.
What's the time delay of the signal from the stimulus?
Excuse me?
What is the time delay of the stimulus and get the signal?
You know, from the time you see noticeable activity, it's like 2 or 3 cycles, right? So it was kind of my comment at the beginning that I mean, it's not super slow. It's you see maybe 2 to 3 cycles, but it's a little bit. But again, you have to also keep in mind that the synchrony is starting up, but then also the firing rate itself is sort of starting up. So let me just show you here. I'm not trying to give you the impression that everything is fuzzy in biology, but I mean, it's not like all of a sudden an object enters a receptive field. The receptive field is sharp, right? And then all of a sudden it starts to fire. This is an object moving at a certain speed, a few degrees per second across the visual field, and maybe the size of the field itself is 5 degrees, but it starts up smoothly, okay. But once you're sort of into substantial firing, I mean, you're sort of firing already by 1/3 of the way in which you begin to see vestiges of synchrony, right? It's tough to define, right? You're asking what the cross-correlation is. You need to average over a couple cycles, right? I mean, if it was 2 cycles, you couldn't even tell technically what was going on. Yeah?
I think there's a gradient in the natural oscillator frequency across the pearl visual cortex, like there is across the slug brain?
I don't think so, just because of the way that. Well, okay. We weren't able to do an experiment where we sort of diced up the cortex into 2. We were able to do experiments in which we put. This data actually brought. We're able to do an experiment. We could put these long spears in with lots of wires and very carefully measure the currents flowing along a column, right, and establish very carefully the phase, because the currents change as you go deeper, as inputs change. But that doesn't really answer your question. It doesn't. You see the relative phasing between areas change over time. I mean, what's once a traveling wave then becomes a rotating wave. Right, so it was once a phase gradient going this way, now it changes its direction. What we couldn't do technically is sort of go in with a cookie cutter and cut out little pieces of cortex and look at the underlying frequency. Okay, I mean, and the difference here really was there's just too many neuromodulators running around that the frequency, the cells are just turned off. Right, so anything you did would completely destroy, you know, that measurement. Yeah.
So it wasn't clear to me how the stimulus changes the traveling
wave synchronization. In the case of WiMAX or in the case of the CAT, it's in the absence of a all the experiments done were done with single specific stimuli. So in the absence of a stimulus, right, so like in the case of the visual experiment, you're just looking at a blank wall, but anticipating that a stimulus could come. Okay, in the WiMAX, it's very hard to talk about anticipation, but again, in a world which was free of odor, right, just streaming air, okay, you have traveling waves. And then when the stimulus came, like the bar in the case of the visual experiment or the odorant, then it causes this switch. To synchrony. So how do you see this? You can see it as follows. You need a stimulus. You need to put in an interaction that has some sort of 3 terms. It needs to have 1 term that depends, say, on the presynaptic activity. Right. Let's think of neurons let's think of 2 areas of visual cortex that interact when a bar goes across at the same orientation. Right. This seems what the experiment suggests. I have like 2 bars, one excites here and one excites here, when they're same orientation, the area is synchronized, but when they're different orientations, so the experiment is kind of like, it's like Jerry Ford, right? Like this, doesn't quite synchronize, okay? So I need to depend on something that has the activity of the presynaptic cells, so the cells at this location, the activity of the postsynaptic cells, what's happening in this location, and then I need to have a middle term, which is really the architecture, right? So if this architecture connects cells, we'll say in the case of vision, you might say there's an orientation, this is the orientation preference for the postsynaptic cell, and there's an orientation preference for the presynaptic cell. If this architecture connects cells with similar orientation presence, then this is a mechanism by which the interactions depend on the stimulus. Okay, so you have access to the activity of the cells. And in the case of vision, what you know is that different cells tend to prefer, which means they tend to fire preferentially at different orientations of the stimulus. So I could use this activation plus the right architecture in my interaction. Now, I just described this putting this in by hand. I think what's really implicit in this original Kuramoto calculation and what was shown both in work by fellow Eric Grannon, who was a postdoc with Sompolinski and myself at Bell, and by fellow Schuster in Germany, is that you get this kind of activity-dependent interaction sort of out of the dynamics of the neurons themselves. So you get something that has this functional form, okay, at least, but it just comes from the dynamics of oscillators.
Do you need external input for all the cells, or just some
cells? No, you only need external, so, I mean, if just in this sort of, you just have to have external inputs into these cells to activate them, and external inputs might be, so let's say this is a cluster of neurons, and this is another cluster. And then cells that like just to jump, like this orientation, tend to be hooked up, and cells that like this orientation tend to be hooked up. Maybe, you know, in a soft way, right? But there's some specificity to the input. You need to excite this guy and excite this guy. So you can kind of see how depending how the architecture goes and depending on which population of cells you're exciting by the external input, you can get an interaction of this form. Okay, so this much you always have to put in by hand, and kind of these activation terms will come out of the dynamics. Although I have to admit I don't have a lot of intuition into this.